It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Wisconsin honors the more than 360,000 veterans across the state, lawmakers at the Capitol are debating legislation aimed at supporting service members.
The bills include everything from education to tax credits and mental health. And a top issue for many advocates and lawmakers is homelessness.
The Veterans Administration estimates that in January of 2024, more than 32,000 veterans were experiencing homelessness nationwide. That number has gone down over the last decade, but it's something lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are working to address, especially after the closure of facilities for homeless veterans in Green Bay and Chippewa Falls.
Republican Assembly Representative Benjamin Franklin of DePere served in the U.S. Air Force and is vice chair of the Assembly Committee on Veterans and Military Affairs. Representative Franklin, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Democratic Assembly Representative Angelito Tenorio of West Allis served in the Wisconsin National Guard from 25 to 2018. He's also on the Committee on Veterans and Military Affairs. Representative Tenorio, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. It's great to be with you.
Representative Franklin, as we mark Veterans Day today, there's a passel of various bills out there related to veterans. Big picture before we get into specifics, what are your priorities on this committee when it comes to working for Wisconsin veterans?
Yeah, well, again, thanks for having me. And first and foremost, I'd like to just say happy Veterans Day to everybody that has served our country or family members. You know, family members sacrifice so much as well. It's kind of unspoken in the military community, but really just appreciate everything that they do. So priorities, you know, anything that we can do to help veterans. And I think right now the elephant in the room that we hear so much about is a VHRP program right now for homeless veterans. And so that is front and center in our crosshairs that we're really trying to find a solution to get that issue resolved in the state of Wisconsin. And there have been several bills that came out to address that. And I'm sure we'll get into the teeth of that here in a little bit. But I've been on all of those bills, really just trying to find a solution to that problem.
And Representative Tenorio, your priorities as we mark Veterans Day.
Happy Veterans Day to you and to all veterans across Wisconsin. It's great to be here. My big priorities as a former service member in the Wisconsin Army National Guard, this is very personal to me and my community and veterans in my district. Providing funding and resources, addressing mental health issues, making sure that veterans have the support they need as they transition back to civilian life, especially resources when it comes to mental health, affordable housing, and making sure that we're supporting unhoused veterans, giving them the resources and support and the sheltering that they need in order to provide for themselves and their families. That's really important to me as I continue to advocate on this committee. And Democrats, we proposed a number of solutions to these issues. Unfortunately, Republicans have stripped these out of the past budget that was recently signed this past summer. But we're continuing to advocate at the committee level to provide housing, to provide mental health resources, and to make Veterans Day a state holiday in Wisconsin, because we're currently the only state in the union that does not honor Veterans Day as a state holiday.
Housing, Representative Franklin, both of you mentioned it. Very short history. As Representative Tenorio mentioned, Governor Evers included funding for these veterans' homes in Chippewa Falls and Green Bay that are now closed. Republicans took that out of the budget but said, hang on, there's some unused money already existing in the budget. Shift that over. Evers administration says, well, we don't think we can legally do that. Okay, that puts us where we are. You are involved in a couple pieces of legislation to provide some of this funding. What are you looking at, Representative Franklin?
Yeah, so kind of how this unfolded, you just hit it right on the head. When it went through the Joint Finance Committee, which I am not on, that was stricken from the budget for a lot of the reasons that you just said. You know, we did approve a 15% increase to the Veterans Trust Fund, which is typically where that money largely comes out of. And, you know, instead of sitting here pointing fingers, from my perspective, I'm just really trying to get solutions done. So after that all fell out, there was a Democrat-authored bill that came out that I signed on to because it restores the $1.9 million that the governor was initially asking for. And then there were a couple other bills that I have personally been working on as well to address the issue. One was with Senator Jacques as the Senate lead. I was the assembly lead on that bill, and that does not just the VHRP program, but it also funds the MIA program at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, and also expands the threshold for property tax purposes for veterans. And there's a lot kind of in that bill. And so Senator Wimberger and myself, we came out with another bill that was simply a standalone bill that addresses the VHRP alone. And really, I like this bill a lot because in the original bill that the Democrats authored that I signed on to, the 1.9 would just restore the three facilities across the state, Chippewa Falls, Green Bay, and Milwaukee, which has remained open. The Milwaukee one has. But this one would allow funds to be used for non-governmental organizations. It creates a $25 per day per veteran match when the federal funds are used. And it's going to allow veterans to stay closer to home for entities that want to use this, not just pigeonhole into three different areas throughout the state, but actually anywhere throughout the state can use this program. So I think it's a great bill. I think it really helps our veterans. It not only restores the funding there, but it also allows them to stay closer to home.
Representative Tenorio, a few different versions of bills that would restore the $1.9 million that Governor Evers had called for veterans' homes, for homeless veterans in his budget. Is there a version you could see working with Republicans on and trying to get across the finish line?
I believe the version that Democrats have put forward that we've had Republicans sign on to is the way we move forward, restoring that funding and getting these veterans' homes back open in the Chippewa Falls region and the Green Bay area. It's important that we prioritize veterans. And I believe one of the things I'm excited about to serve on the Committee on Veterans and Military Affairs is that this is a place where we can have bipartisanship because veterans, they've served our country, they've put their lives on the line and their families too. And it's really important that we honor the contract and that we lower costs for veterans and we provide them with housing, with resources when it comes to job transitions, mental health, education benefits, and really making sure that we're honoring the contract and provide veterans with the support and resources they need to thrive because they've given so much to our state and our communities.
Representative Franklin, I'm hearing a lot of from both of you and others this a lot of concern wanting to get this $1.9 million in there, but there's different versions, there's different movements in both chambers. Do you think that a compromise is going to happen to get this ultimately signed into law?
You know, I do think that we'll get there, and I think I think the other representative just hit it right on the head. This is an issue with veterans that typically, you know, there's not a division of party lines, hopefully anyway. From my vantage point, I really feel like this is something we can work together on. And again, going back to this, I do not want to use veterans as political footballs. I think that is absolutely horrible that people would ever do something like that. And I'm literally trying to find any means necessary. That's why I don't care if it's a Democrat-authored bill. I don't care if it's a Republican-authored bill. A good bill is a good bill, and I'm going to put my name on it, and I'm going to fight for it. And, you know, our veterans deserve representatives that fight for them.
Representative Franklin, let's stay with you. Another piece of legislation co-authored would change the definition of veteran to allow former members of U.S. Army Reserves or the National Guard to indicate their veteran status on their driver's license or ID card. Why was this a priority for you?
You know, it may not sound like a very big thing, but there, to your point, there's a lot of different definitions out there of what a veteran actually is. And a little known stat that a lot of people do not really know is guardsmen and reservists actually deploy more than active duty members by and large. There are a few exceptions based on MOS or AFSC in the Air Force term, but by and large, they actually deploy more. And so if anybody is deserving of a veteran status, it doesn't matter to me if you're active duty, guard, or reserve. Everybody should have the right to identify as a veteran when they, you know, have given so much, not just themselves, but their families in service of their country.
Representative Tenorio, you're a co-sponsor on a bill that adds more funds for programs that support veterans' mental health and substance use recovery. What are you hoping to accomplish with this bill?
I'm hoping to make sure that veterans get the support and resources they need. I'm proud to be a lead author on a couple of bills relating to mental health. one related to the Veterans Outreach and Recovery Program through Wisconsin DVA, Wisconsin Department of Veteran Affairs, making sure that the state agency has the resources and staffing that they need in order to meet veterans where they're at and provide them with the services they need as well. I'm also proud to lead a bill related to mental health initiatives, providing grants to organizations in the community that veterans are living in to make sure that veterans have that support, because it's important that we break down and end the stigma that comes with mental health. Because a lot of veterans, as I've been knocking doors, as I've been in the community, meeting with stakeholders, a lot of veterans struggle with PTSD and the transition back to civilian life. And it's really important that the state, the legislature, that we work together and pass common sense legislation like the ones that Democrats have introduced to meet veterans where they're at, provide them with the support and resources and tools they need in order to provide for themselves and their families.
Representative Franklin, briefly, as we wrap up, do you have priorities for funding and support services for veterans' mental health and substance use?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, if you look at my track record since I've been here, I am a freshman. That's the word we use around the Capitol. I'm a brand new legislator this term. And one of my priorities, even in the budget, was funding for the 988. There was a lot of concern that with the federal situation and funding that was going on there, the DOGE cuts, et cetera, that the funding for 988 hotline was at risk. And so, you know, I asked for $12 million in that in a piece that we pushed forward. We ended up getting $7 million. And, you know, when I visited that facility up in Green Bay that runs all the 988 call centers around the state, it all funnels through that area. And I'm happy to report that they said that is sufficient enough to keep that critical need going forward.
Thanks to both of our guests for joining us today. We've been talking to Representative Benjamin Franklin, a Republican, and Angelita Tenorio, a Democrat. They are both on the Assembly Committee on Veterans and Military Affairs, talking about top priorities on that committee as the nation marks Veterans Day.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, Milwaukee's police chief and mayor join the show for a look at efforts to crack down on reckless driving and the impact of a new state law.
These are preventable deaths. These are preventable injuries. And we're all working and rolling in the same direction to stop them.
That's ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A long-running effort aims to crack down on reckless driving in Milwaukee, and city leaders say a new state law offers them a new tool in that campaign.
Since he entered office, Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson has called reckless driving a public safety crisis.
And last week, Mayor Johnson signed a reckless driving bill for the city after Governor Evers signed a state law allowing local officials to pass ordinances addressing the issue.
The new law in Milwaukee increases penalties for reckless driving and allows police to seize vehicles from more offenders.
At the same time, bills have been introduced in the state legislature to bring red light and speed enforcement cameras to Milwaukee and to require speed-limiting devices for repeat offenders.
Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson joins us now. Mayor Johnson, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Back when you became mayor a few years back, you declared reckless driving a public safety crisis. Why do you think Milwaukee has such a serious reckless driving problem compared to elsewhere in the state?
Well, I think that there's a number of reasons for that. I think there are issues in other parts of Wisconsin, too. That's why it's gotten to the attention of the governor, because there are statewide solutions that are needed on reckless driving. But it's not just a Milwaukee thing or even a Wisconsin thing. This is something that happened across the United States. As a matter of fact, I speak with a number of mayors that are also a part of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, along with me. And in their communities, reckless driving had also spiked. And I think for a number of communities, it was COVID related. You had wide open roads, not a lot of people driving on them, so people took some additional liberties. I think in Milwaukee specifically, there are some things that added to that, including the fact that police for some time didn't have a tool in their toolkit that they had at their disposal for a number of years that discouraged that sort of behavior. And so we've been working to put the genie back in the bottle on that over the past number of years by empowering police, by working with our Department of Public Works to make sure that we're focusing in on street designs that are safer and focusing in on that, on safety as opposed to speed, amongst other things like Vision Zero and the like.
I want to dig into a bunch of the different things you just brought up. Let's start with those statewide tools. We got this new law passed by the legislature, signed by Governor Evers, that frees some things up for municipalities like yours to tackle. What do you see? What kind of difference do you see these new changes making?
Look, I think that we need every single tool at our disposal. And so the state needs to be a partner with us and other communities too on these sort of initiatives. And so the bill that the governor signed just recently allows for the police department to have an additional tool. It has to be passed by a local ordinance and signed by the mayor. Our city council of Milwaukee passed an ordinance after the governor affixed his signature to the bill. I immediately signed it as soon as the council voted on it to allow for police to be able to impound vehicles of individuals who are driving cars recklessly, treating them as 2,000-pound weapons, regardless of whether or not the owner is using the vehicle or not. It requires people to be a little more responsible, too, in terms of who you might loan your car out to. And so we're very, very happy with that. It's another tool in the toolbox, another bill that is seeking to work its way through the legislative process in Madison right now is a traffic safety camera program. Traffic safety cameras that would be deployed in Milwaukee on a pilot basis with limited cameras in each of the 15 aldermanic districts to capture people on camera who are speeding through red lights, going through red lights, and going over 15 miles per hour over the speed limit. That's what would trigger a citation to happen. And we're not doing this as some, you know, critics on the Republican side, especially in the legislature, have spoken about. We're doing it to gain compliance, to make the streets safer for people in Milwaukee. And other communities across the country have done the same thing.
Another proposed state bill would require reckless driving offenders, repeat offenders, to have speed limiters put on their cars. Is that something you're backing in the legislature?
That's not something that I'm not immediately backing, because I want people not to speed in the first place. That bill would require that the act to happen. I want people to not speed in the first place. I want people to not drive recklessly in the first place. That's why we've been so adamant about working to make sure that we have tools to curb that sort of behavior, whether it's things that we have been initiating since I've been the mayor and declared reckless driving a public safety crisis and have corralled all of local government, all of city government to work on the issue, whether it's focusing in on these preventative measures to make people think twice before driving recklessly, like the traffic safety cameras, or the bill that the governor signed and, you know, the council passed and I signed, where we're putting the message out that, hey, do not do this because your car could be impounded. We're trying to get to people on the front end as opposed to the back end.
Outside of the enforcement side of things, you've also worked on infrastructure on the streets themselves, kind of road modifications to make them a little slower and a little less likely to drive too fast. What kind of things are you doing? What kind of changes have you, or what kind of impact have you seen?
Yeah, we have been transforming the streets in Milwaukee. And let me be the first one to tell you, I mean, I wish that we were not in a position where we'd had to do that. I wish that folks would just take into account their own well-being. And if you're not thinking about yourself, thinking about the well-being of your neighbors and folks around us in our community. And so we have taken that up because some of those things just haven't been happening, and making sure that we go for grants and design roads in our Department of Public Works that focus in on safety over speed. Right. So there's road diets that have happened. There's protected bike lanes that have gone in, which is, you know, something that's an amenity for you know, bike riders and scooter riders, getting them, you know, off of sidewalks and things like that. But it also helps to deter reckless driving. We put in pinned-on curb extensions to stop people from passing on the right, which is one of the most notorious things that reckless drivers have done in our community. So we've done a number of things, speed humps, speed tables, roundabouts, traffic circles, you know, in order to curb that sort of antisocial behavior on our roadways. And it is having a positive effect. There are, I believe, 7% fewer people who have died in traffic crashes in Milwaukee over last year from this year. The other way around, from last year to this year. So we are having some progress. We are seeing speeds slow on those streets where we've made those improvements, which is making it safer for everybody in our community. And that's a good thing.
Mayor Johnson, how about a culture change? Is there some kind of messaging to get out there to, apart from the enforcement, obviously that's part of this, but to make sure that people think about driving safely and don't drive so recklessly?
Yes, and that's where, you know, Vision Zero, which Milwaukee is a proud partner. I believe we are the second community in the state of Wisconsin to be a part of the Vision Zero network. The first was Madison some years ago, and so we've joined Madison in the effort here, focusing in on ending traffic deaths in our community. And so that's a culture change. Vision Zero applies a number of things, including working with members of the community who are concerned about traffic violence and these unnecessary traffic crashes resulting from people who take the liberty to drive recklessly behind the wheel. But there's also education that's associated with this as well, including the Speeding We Can Live Without It educational campaign that Vision Zero has been champion of over the course of the last year or so.
It seems like over the last couple of years, Mayor Johnson, everybody's on the same page mostly on this issue. Your office, the city council, the community, state government as well. Do you feel like you've got a team here that you're working with and the partnerships are really going to put a dent in this?
Yeah, and I feel really good about where we're going. Again, when my very first day in office as mayor, I declared reckless driving a public safety crisis, and we have been tackling the issue head on. And as you know, folks, you know, hear me talking about constantly, getting more partners in order to address the situation. You need these important partnerships, and so I'm happy that members of the city council have been on board. I'm happy that the Milwaukee County also adopted a Vision Zero policy as well. I'm also happy that leaders in state government, including you know the two that I was on a panel discussion with this past Monday, Senator Dora Drake and Senator LaTanya Johnson, amongst others. Representative Caitlin Haywood was there as well, have been champions of this effort in making our streets safer for all users of the roadway. That's super important. And, you know, it's unnecessary when, you know, people lose their lives to traffic violence because somebody decides to go out there and speed. These are preventable deaths. These are preventable injuries. And we're all working and rolling in the same direction to stop them.
Mayor Johnson, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate it.
Cavalier Johnson is the mayor of Milwaukee. We talked with him about reckless driving in the city after he signed a bill into law last week, increasing penalties and allowing police to seize vehicles of reckless drivers. Now we'll hear about what law enforcement is seeing in Milwaukee. Jeffrey Norman is chief of police at the Milwaukee Police Department. Chief Norman, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Appreciate being invited.
What are your officers seeing on the streets of Milwaukee in recent years that qualifies as reckless driving? Paint us a picture of what you're seeing there.
Well, this has been a challenge throughout my administration. This has been a challenge over the course of the years. This is nothing new, unfortunately, in regards to behaviors that are, again, dangerous on the road, excessive high speeds, swerving in and out. They have the term called the Milwaukee slide, which is, you know, passing cars on your right, which at times those who are, you know, not paying attention could unfortunately get into unnecessary accidents. Things that just basically unacceptable in regards to our rules of the road and respecting those who are driving, you know, and again, in a more respectful manner. So this has been, unfortunately, a chronic issue for us in our city.
Now, reckless driving has been with us as long as there have been cars, I guess, but have you seen things get worse? I hear people pointing toward the COVID era in particular as kind of a turning point where we see more of this.
So, been on a job for 30 years. Mm-hmm. It has been an issue over the course of the years, especially a couple administrations ago. So this is nothing that I will say is new. I believe that when we did have the COVID 2020, there was, I will say, amplification or exasperation of, you know, behaviors really starting to get pretty bad in regards to there was, you know, moratorium and, you know, traffic enforcement for certain, you know, violations. So there was a lot of things I believe contributing to aggravating the situation in the more recent years. And it calls for, again, any tool that we can have that will, you know, help us be able to impact and disrupt the behaviors. You know, the Milwaukee Police Department, the political leaders in our city are all for it.
Let's talk about those tools. We've got this recently signed state law. And then, as we just heard from the mayor, the city of Milwaukee put it into effect, opening up the ability to seize vehicles involved in reckless driving. Is that a tool you think is going to help move the needle?
Absolutely. I don't speak too often on a lot of different things from a legislative angle, but this is one that I felt compelled just because I believe there is true impact when you have the ability to take away what I will say the modality to, contribute to the reckless driving in our city. Seeing that this is a opportunity to really have a true impact for those who are first offense, understanding the seriousness of this, that we will impound your vehicle, I believe will send a very strong signal that we're not taking this lightly, and that, you know, there's going to be owner responsibility if you loan out your vehicle. Understand that you are, you know, putting your vehicle at risk if you loan it out to the individual who does not understand that responsibility, and those who are driving the vehicle, that they have to understand the responsibility to, if you are borrowing a vehicle, you need to make sure that you're following the rules of the road. Otherwise, there will be serious consequences.
How about charges for repeat offenders and automatically charging them? How big a help could that be?
So we have, again, a pretty good working relationship with our, system partners in the criminal justice system. The city attorney had made it clear, especially our most recent town hall, that anything that is a second offense, reckless driving, will not be handled at the municipal level. Our partner, the DA's office, Kent Laverne, has stated that they're committed to prosecuting those who are involved in a second offense at a state level charge. And so these are commitments that our system partners are making in conjunction with ourselves. So it helps to have a unified front. Our, you know, city leaders, the mayor, in fact, is very much behind this particular type of effort. And most importantly, our community is behind this effort. So we are moving a needle in regards to those particular type of prosecutions at that level.
Chief Norman, I don't have data in front of me here on this, but I would guess if I had to that we're mostly talking about younger people being involved in these charges. That's my guess, though. Do I have that about right?
So we can provide you with more information, but I know from some of the data that we do have, yes, it's younger people, but I don't want to excuse anybody from these behaviors. We do see a lot between the 18 to 24 age, but, you know, it is higher. I know that there is, you know, issues in regards to those who are going to work, those who are at work, those who are delivery drivers engaging in these unfortunate violations of the rules of the road. So, yes, there is a, you know, we can see that there is more of those violations in that age, but I've seen it all spectrums, all levels.
How do you get the message out there to that younger group? And, you know, hopefully they'll grow up to be older drivers, too, and keep driving safe. How do you reach that audience of new drivers to say to get it into their heads that this is dangerous?
Well, first of all, Rob, I think this is a great venue. I believe that using the media to help us amplify our message. We're working with our political partners out there to, again, send out these notifications and notices in their own, you know, world. I mean, social media is also a great tool. knowing that a lot of our, you know, public look at social media feeds. We do have a pretty good social media following. So this is where we lean into the opportunity to talk to anyone, anywhere, to continue to amplify these particular warnings of these particular laws are out here. The Milwaukee Police Department is empowered with this particular tool, and that we will use it, and it is directed for officers to use it. So it's important for us to keep on saying this. I always say to my team, we can never communicate enough. Communicate, communicate. When you think you communicate enough, you communicate some more.
I want to bring up the issue of police pursuit, and we've watched this in Milwaukee and elsewhere over the years, this difficult balancing act of, you know, a traffic pursuit, a high-speed pursuit is a dangerous situation. But if you move too far to the other extreme and say, well, no pursuits, and people know there's no pursuits, then they will they'll know that and get away. How have you been dealing with that balancing act?
Well, I'm glad that you really put the word or take the words right out of my mouth in regards to this is a balancing act. Understanding that we as a department need to lean into our training, the accountability measures, but we need to support our officers, understand that there is and has been needs for, especially when you see violent crime, especially when you see those levels of utter disregard and reckless driving, that there should be some type of intervention. But we cannot allow this to be just, anything goes for our department. We need to make sure that we are being, you know, mindful when we want to engage in these pursuits. But you're absolutely right. The alternative is not acceptable to the community. We have done anecdotal discussions with our community through crime and safety meetings, through other engagements, and our community still is behind that they cannot see a world where there is no accountability or some type of intervention methods for those who are bringing, you know, harm or dangers to our roads or to our community.
Chief Norman, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Appreciate the invitation, and take care.
Jeffrey Norman is chief of police at the Milwaukee Police Department. Earlier, we heard from Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson. We've been talking about efforts to crack down on reckless driving in Milwaukee.
Just ahead, community fridges are popping up in cities around Wisconsin. Hear from organizers in the Fox Valley on how these stocked fridges are helping neighbors in need.
It's similar to other community fridges, a open concept where we trust the visitors to know best what they need.
Fridges available to anyone, anytime. That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In a public park or church parking lot in your community, you might see a refrigerator running year-round and filled with food for neighbors in need to take for free.
Stocked with fresh fruits, vegetables, and ready-to-eat meals, community fridges are popping up around Wisconsin, and a new network of community fridges is coming to Milwaukee.
As budgets are stretched thin, volunteers who are restocking these fridges around the state say they're needed now more than ever to fight hunger. We're going to meet people behind some of the community fridges in the Fox Valley region.
TJ Hobbs is co-founder of Hope Fridge in Oshkosh and Menasha. TJ, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate, for having me.
And Kelsey Letso is here, co-founder of The Fridge in Green Bay. Kelsey, welcome as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Kelsey, tell us about what a community fridge is exactly and how it works.
Sure. A community fridge is a regular refrigerator similar to what you would have in your own kitchen, except it is outside and it is accessible by anyone in the community. And that is to both like donate and give food and to take food. So we like to call it a hub for sharing food. Our motto is take what you need and share what you can. And it's just a really good way for neighbors to look after each other, especially in hard times. And it also reduces food waste in the community and just builds community in general.
What items might people find in the fridge in Green Bay?
Yeah, we really love the fridge because a lot of traditional pantries will focus more on like non-perishable items, so like boxed pastas and canned goods and things like that, which are great, but there's that missing like nutritional element of having access to produce and dairy and, you know, proteins, things like that. So we get a lot of vegetables, a lot of fruit, a lot of cheese, just things that everyone should have in their diet and things that people often have an excess of or maybe waste a little bit more often than other food items. So that's the primary focus is those nutrient dense foods.
Yeah. TJ, tell us about Hope Fridge. What is it like?
Oh, sure. Hope Fridge it's fantastic, and it is a community project in action. So there are so many people behind the scenes working together to make Hope Fridge a reality for the folks that live in the Fox Cities area. It's similar to other community fridges, a open concept where we trust the visitors to know best what they need because they're the ones in their own lived experience that know exactly how much food their family's looking for and also have preferences, you know, and like anyone else. And kind of bouncing off what Kelsey said, I wanted to share accessibility comes in many forms. And one of those forms is allowing folks who need food the ability to enjoy ready-to-eat food, right? So often, you know, food stamps, I believe, aren't even able to purchase a lot of ready-to-eat food. They just, I guess, assume that people working two jobs, struggling to pay their bills, like somehow still have time to cook in between. So we love especially seeing folks making fresh food, making homemade meals, labeling those individually, and then putting them into our fridges for folks to take home and enjoy that may not otherwise be able to cook for themselves due to either disability or life just asking too much of them at that moment.
Who monitors what's in the fridge, TJ, and, you know, keeping the items rotating and fresh?
Yeah, so everybody. I know it sounds silly, but we really do work together on that. We ask that everybody who visits leaves the fridge cleaner than you found it, right? So if you see something in there that, you know, this lettuce is getting a little wilty and you toss it out if it was in your fridge, we ask you to do the same if you see that at our community fridges. But honestly, food rarely gets thrown away at our fridges because sadly the need is so great. But we're there getting food redistributed into communities multiple times a day. We, you know, have anywhere from dozens to hundreds of visitors per hour, per day, you know, up to hundreds of visitors per day at each fridge. So if you can imagine how quickly that food that's going in there, it's sometimes gone in 5 minutes. Sometimes it's gone in a few hours, but it all moves very quickly because the need is so great, especially now.
Kelsey, do you find that food rarely spoils at the community fridge in Green Bay?
Yeah, absolutely. Similar to what TJ said, you know, there is concern when you're talking to someone for the first time about a community fridge, like, how do you make sure the food doesn't go bad? And the sad reality is that, you know, I could put something in there right now and go back in an hour and it'll likely be gone. There's lots of people who access these community fridges and, the need is there. So,
Kelsey, you mentioned the refrigerator is outside. It's accessible to people. What about the energy bill and the electricity needed to run it?
Yeah, we've been really fortunate in our community, and hopefully other communities feel the same, where we have two fridges in the Green Bay area, and our host sites both installed the electricity for us. And donated that service and materials and all of that. And then they also pay the monthly utility bill.
TJ, how about you? What is that like, that setup like for powering these community fridges?
Right. So similar to Kelsey, we've had hosts in the past donate and pay for donate the electrical install. The paying for it portion, as far as we're concerned, that's one of the agreements that needs to be made in order for a host to be willing to host, is basically, are you able to cover an extra 20 so bucks a month for electricity for an additional fridge as your ongoing donation to this project? And that's just one of the expectations that we have out of a Hope Fridge partnership with a host, just because it just makes everything so much easier for us to just be the boots on the ground. We don't typically ask the hosts to maintain the fridge itself, though, other than the electric bill. And that's because we definitely want to prevent host burnout. And we have a volunteer team to help make sure these fridges stay clean, that they stay organized. But yeah, we're working right now on a little e-booklet, hopefully to be published soon, about how to start your own community fridge. And in there, we'll be mentioning a GFI electrical outlet, if you're doing this outside, is crucial. So that's for safety, to be up to code, and just to not have any interruptions. A GFI outlet has a little cover on it when it's outside too, to keep rain out and just keep everything safe for everybody. We've crowdfunded that in the past. When we had a fridge at a residence, the residence was able to host the fridge, but unable to pay for the electrical install. So the community rallied together to fundraise for that. But we've been lucky too with hosts sometimes being willing and able to cover that initial outlet install cost, which is really the biggest initial upstarting cost. Other than the wood, if you're going to be building an outdoor enclosure, that's a cost to consider as well. But all can be crowdfunded, especially when you tell your community what you're doing. They want to help. So you're going to have people with more time than money, some people with more money than time. And your job as a connector to start this, if you'd like, is to bring those people together and openly communicate how to do this and be flexible as you learn as you go.
We're talking about community fridges with TJ Hobbs there at the Hope Fridge in Oshkosh and Kelsey Lutzo, who's with us with the fridge in Green Bay. Kelsey, how do you get the word out? How do you, share out what's available at any given time since, I would imagine things are really rotating through the community fridge?
For sure. This has been a little bit of a learning experience. We primarily use Facebook to share updates on the fridge, but we did find sometimes, we love when volunteers will send us a photo and say, I just filled the fridge, and we would love to share and celebrate and give them a shout out and just, continue to spread the word. But we also are mindful of people seeing that and getting excited and getting their hopes up and going to the fridge only to find that somebody else had been there and that contents is no longer in the fridge. So we do just try to, recognize those emotions can be unfortunate. It could be a bummer if you were really looking forward to that. We try to keep those types of posts a little bit more minimal. But yeah, we do continue to share what we're up to and just try to keep it relevant in people's minds. We started 2.5 years ago, and I think, sometimes people could see it and get really excited about it and then kind of forget. So trying to be continually in people's social media feeds to say, hey, we're still here as a resource to donate, as a resource to find food, that type of thing.
And you have roughly 4 volunteers. Is it hard to find enough volunteers?
It can be. Like TJ said, there are people who have more time than money, and there are people who have more money than time. And we see a lot more people willing to donate financially to the fridge, which is amazing. So now it's just a matter of making sure that we have enough people to keep it sustained, especially in today's climate. There's a higher need of food at the moment. And so we've been having conversations about expanding, and we just want to make sure that whatever expansions we are doing will be maintained by volunteers, and we're not, you know, biting off more than we can chew.
Yeah. TJ, I understand you're planning on expanding into Appleton for another fridge. Can you talk about this scale up and what the expansion entails?
Well, yes, but also not very specifically because I'm not the one leading that charge. But I can tell you that, you know, similar to Kelsey, we're going slow. We're trying to be measured in this and not burn out the people that we already have working, because this is a lot of free volunteer labor that it takes to open and then maintain a new location. So for us, you know, We may be expanding soon into Appleton because we already have a strong volunteer network in Appleton. But we're also looking to inspire and empower new community fridge leaders in cities that we don't have that strong volunteer network already established, right? If the energy is there and folks are looking for opening their own community fridge, or they'd like to see one started in their community, we're, if anything, even more trying to push them starting their own community fridge, picking their own name, finding their own location, and us to be here as a resource for questions, like the Love Fridge in Chicago was for us when we first started. We didn't want to reinvent the wheel. We wanted to reach out to someone who had been doing this successfully for a very long time. The Love Fridge in Chicago was amazing. Risa Haynes was fantastic and gave advice to me when we were first starting and helped answer so many of my questions. And we would love to be able to be that for other local community leaders that are just coming up in their own communities to help them start their own fridges. Don't wait for us to come to you. You make it happen for your community.
Kelsey, in Green Bay, have you seen a shift in need as we see grocery prices rising, you know, the difficulties around the food share program? What have you seen with need?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that we talked about a lot when we were first starting is just the, you know, the everyday dollar and the SNAP benefits just aren't stretching as far as they used to. And it's tough. I mean, I can speak for my family. I would, you know, typically we are fine day to day, week to week, whatever it is. But as time has been going by, you can really feel that the money you had just isn't getting you as far as it used to. And for families who are, you know, right in that point of living paycheck to paycheck or whatever it is, like, it's just needing a little bit of extra help to make those ends meet.
Well, Kelsey and TJ, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing about your community fridges.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Kate.
That is Kelsey Lutzo, co-founder of The Fridge in Green Bay, and TJ Hobbs, co-founder of Hope Fridge in Oshkosh and Menasha. And they joined us to talk about the community fridges in the Fox Valley region and the efforts of volunteers to help neighbors around the state combat food insecurity in tight times.
Some Sturgeon Bay residents are rallying around an Ice Age Trail thru-hiker from Japan, and Kay in Stoughton has been following along.
Kay wrote in to say that a group is organizing to walk the last few miles with thru-hiker Masafumi Saito to celebrate his 1,200-mile accomplishment.
Kay goes on to say it's been a journey of community, as many people have hiked with Saito, some have hosted him overnight in their homes, others have left him aid packages along the way. Those unexpected treats are called trail magic.
Share your story about this thru-hiker or others who've taken on the challenge. Rob, I'm thinking of Emily Ford right now, who became the first woman to thru-hike the Ice Age Trail in the winter.
Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us to share about the Ice Age Trail. That number is 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummy, Beatrice Lawrence, and Royce Padezwa.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.